From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the cure for catastrophe. And I hope you had an enjoyable Labor Day weekend. Back to work tomorrow. Yeah, for some of us, we've been working all along. Police say they are doing extra patrols in a Winston-Salem neighborhood after two children reported seeing a clown trying to lure kids into the woods with treats. Jeez, the suspect tried to lure these kids, and the suspect reportedly seen by two children, heard not seen by one adult. The suspect fled the area when officers arrived. I don't know how you can hide in a clown's outfit. Her mind continued to twist hundreds of miles offshore in the Atlantic Ocean and was expected to keep swimmers and surfers out of beach waters because of its very dangerous waves and rip currents on the last day of the long holiday weekend. It was expected to stall over the water before weakening once again. U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies are probing what they see as a broad, covert Russian operation in the United States to sow public distrust in the upcoming presidential election and U.S. political institutions. The aim is to understand the scope and intent of the Russian campaign, which apparently incorporates cyber tools to hack systems used in the political process, enhancing Russia's ability to spread disinformation. Let's check in with Dr. Jerry Corsi from WorldNet Daily. Jerry, this seems pretty serious. Why would the Russians do this?
Well, that's a good question, George. I think the working hypothesis is that Russia wants to cause disorder and distrust in the U.S. political system. It still lacks proof positive that Russia is actually doing the cyber crimes of breaking into political systems in the United States. I mean, it's clearly a threat, but it hasn't been proved definitively that Russia is behind this. Russia still denies it. And there's a political story here in that the Democrats would like to change the narrative from the 20,000 emails on the Democratic National Committee that ultimately got Debbie Wasserman Schultz fired as chairman of the Democratic National Committee for biasing the election in favor of Hillary Clinton away from Bernie Sanders. But I think the bottom line, George, in terms until there's proof positive, is one of the things it does stress is the need to go back to paper ballots.
Yes.
The degree to which these, you know, voting machines can be tampered with, and we'd eliminate a lot of the cyber threat if we merely return to paper ballots.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest, what's left of it, of your Labor Day weekend. Phyllis Schlafly, the iconic pro-family activist who rose to the fame in the 1970s when she campaigned against the Equal Rights Amendment, has died at the age of 92. Here in the St. Louis area. And something's wrong, I got to tell you, with Hillary Clinton. She just can't stop coughing at speeches. Hillary Clinton had a massive coughing fit as she began a Labor Day campaign rally in Cleveland, Ohio. She had trouble speaking and thanking local elected officials and had to stop a number of times to cough and clear her throat. Listen to this.
Happy, happy Labor Day. When we were trying to figure out where we could be, we all said, let's go to Cleveland. And I want to thank Congresswoman Marsha Fudge for hosting us. I've been talking so every time I think about Trump, I get allergic. Boy, we have 63 days to go.
Look, I make a lot of public presentations. It's your biggest nightmare to have that kind of a thing happen. Fortunately, I haven't had that happen to me. But something is wrong with her because she has had this happen way too much. She has had people prop her up from falling down. Let's bring in Dr. John Curtis, who's been with us since the beginning of this election campaign. John, what do you think's going on here?
This goes back to September 15th, actually, 2012, when her handlers said that she had a virus in which she was, you can listen to the explanation, a virus that dehydrated her, caused her to faint, and then she hit her head, developed a subdermal hematoma, and took at least 6 months, if not a year, to recover from that. And then, of course, now you're seeing these coughing fits. Well, you had a lot of speculation out there that she has acid reflux, that she has pulmonary emboli, that she's been treated for too long with anticoagulant drugs called Coumadin, which is warfarin, that she's had other kinds of medical problems that promote more blood clotting, so that she's had to take this Coumadin for that long. But when you really look at it, and you look at the coughing fits, it is very reminiscent of somebody who has had dysphagia from a stroke. And it means that the flow of fluids from the esophagus winds up into the trachea and causes these kind of coughing fits. And I think that when you look at the reports from the campaign media are that she frequently spaces out, that she loses her content and her memory goes, she doesn't know where she is making speeches, and that she can't walk up steps. All of these are showing weakness in the extremities. They're showing cognitive impairments that typically follow a patient, you know, who's had a stroke mm-hmm. and stroke recovery. And the worst possible diagnosis that this campaign would come out with, and as you know, her doctor, her name is Lisa Bardak, has refused to really issue any of her medical records other than to say she's fit as a fiddle, basically, and certainly to run for president. But I think what you have here, you have a fraudulent explanation in 2012 for what happened to her. She had a stroke. That's the most logical explanation. These are post-stroke recovery issues for her. And I think that if that comes out, that would be catastrophic to her campaign.
I think you're right, John. Thank you so much. We'll just keep watching the situation. It's really bizarre. Europe's Rosetta space probe has located its lost lander wedged in a dark crack on a comet. That's an amazing story. Rosetta's camera finally captured images of the lander on the comet weeks before the probe's own mission ends. The pictures show the lander's body and two of its three legs were taken as the Rosetta passed within a mile and a half of the surface. Isn't that something? Twice a month now, we are going to be featuring podcasts of those people doing paranormal shows or conspiracy shows to give them an opportunity to show you what they can do. They don't generally get a lot of exposure. And we're going to highlight tonight the paranormal podcast with Jim Harrell. Listen in.
Being on Ghost Hunters, what did you love about that experience? What were some of your favorite things about that?
Well, I love, obviously, being able to investigate places that you kind of only dream of. You know, I mean, we had full access to a lot of these locations that I had read about and studied for so long, and that was so exciting. I also loved the travel, believe it or not. You know, when I first started, I was at a big turning point in my life, and so I would end up on the road for 8 or 9 weeks at a time. There was one year where I was on the road for 300 days, and it was between Ghost Hunters shooting and appearances and events, I just didn't go home anymore. And it was kind of stressful, but now that I look back on it, I'm actually really nostalgic on those times because I got to see so much of the country. I experienced so much. I made amazing friends. And it was definitely something I'm so glad I did. And honestly, without Ghost Hunters, I never would be here. I never would have met, you know, the love of my life and had my daughter. Like, I met him when we were working in Providence, Rhode Island. And so it all kind of worked somehow.
And that was Jim interviewing paranormal investigator Amy Brunei of the Ghost Hunters fame. Jim, welcome to the program. I'm glad you are here doing what you're doing. I know you interviewed me at an event, but good for you. Now, how do people find you?
All they have to do is go over to jimherold.com, or they can find us on iTunes, the podcast app, and pretty much any audio app out there like iHeartRadio, and tune in. We're pretty much anywhere fine podcasts are heard.
How long have you been doing this now?
That program, the Paranormal Podcast, since 2005. I was kind of one of the early people to jump on the podcasting bandwagon, and it went from a hobby to a career.
And you're having fun doing it too, aren't you?
Oh, it's fantastic. I love what I do. I feel so blessed to get to meet people like you and talk to all of these fascinating guests and, of course, the great listeners who have been so kind to me.
Well, Jim, we are proud to be able to do whatever we can to help you and other podcasters get their word out about what they do, too. And I think it's a big community, and I want it to get even bigger.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there are a ton of new podcasters out there, not just the old guys like me, and it's so exciting. So many voices out there, and thanks to you and Coast to Coast for really promoting it.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Herold. And, of course, in a couple of weeks, we will highlight another podcast that's out there. There are many folks, so we'll be doing this for a long time, and we'll keep in touch. And Tom is doing the research into some of the other podcasts we didn't even know existed, but they're out there. Now, in a moment, we're talking about Dr. Feelgood. What a story. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Richard Lutzman with us, film historian, author, was the award-winning editor of a cinema magazine that looked at classic films and the great directors and writers and editors of our time. His essays and books on cinema have been published worldwide. He is also the award-winning co-author of Dr. Feelgood. He wrote that with our dear friend Dr. Bill Burns, who has written three books with me. And here is Richard on Coast to Coast. What an amazing story, Richard.
It is, George. I appreciate it. It's a story of a great scientist, a brilliant man, who came out of Nazi Germany and emigrated to the United States and really sat in a position of power in the United States and really changed the United States at a time during that really created the drug era in the 60s.
Let me read the rest of the title of the book, Richard, because it'll really give people an idea of what this is. Dr. Feelgood, the shocking story of the doctor who may have changed history by treating and drugging JFK, Maryland, Elvis, and other prominent figures. My God, he got everybody.
Oh, he was, we went through his patient list, and our eyes, a lot of them we could not print because there are people who are alive today. I did an interview recently with an actor, George Segal, who does a show called The Goldbergs. And George said, I read your book. I was a patient of Max Jacobson's for almost 15 years. And it's just mind-boggling of the great writers and politicians. I mean, not just, he was the doctor to Tennessee Williams and Truman Capote. And we got to interview Gore Vidal. But he was also the doctor to Claude Pepper, who was a United States Senator, to Richard Nixon, to Harry Truman,
my God,
and, of course, to John Kennedy.
He died in 1979, so we're not speaking ill of the dead. These are factual events that we're going to talk about tonight. How did he get his start, Richard? What did he do in the beginning?
He trained under Carl Jung. He was a brilliant man in Berlin, and he was actually a researcher and a surgeon. And he was one of the early developers of what became Pervitin, which was a pill that was an amphetamine that was used actually for the German soldiers during World War II. Because he was Jewish, he was tipped off that Hitler was about to arrest him and send him off to the camps. And he had actually trained Hitler's doctor. His name was Theo Morel. And he escaped through Czechoslovakia, went to Paris, and then escaped to the United States with his family, set up in the late 1930s in New York. And his aim was really to use his methamphetamine to treat people with multiple sclerosis. And he actually experimented on himself and became a long-term addict of what he created was his version of methamphetamine, which was a cocktail which was created with sheep sperm and monkey gonads
and eels
and human placenta. It was a concoction that was steroids. It was just a concoction of everything. But what it did was it gave people instant power, instant energy. It took away their pain. And so it helped a lot of his patients with MS. And all of a sudden, the people on Broadway and the great writers were all sent to Max Jacobson for this special concoction that he never really told people what were the contents.
Richard, were his intentions originally all good?
You know, there's so many gray areas with Max Jacobson, but originally his intentions were as a medical doctor that he wanted to create, he wanted to take away the pain from patients that were hopeless. So he really didn't have, in the beginning, an evil intent for anything. What he used it was to gain power, and then he used it not to everybody's benefit at that point.
Was he based out of the L.A. area? I assume he was, with the kind of clientele he had.
No, he was based out of Lexington Avenue in New York City.
Oh, really? Okay.
And his son became a physician in Los Angeles, so he had a kind of a franchise in Los Angeles during the 60s and 70s.
How did he get the code name Dr. Feelgood?
The Secret Service gave him a code name of Dr. Feelgood. We got to interview Paul Landis and know Paul very well, who was the Secret Service agent with Clint Richardson to the Kennedys and to Jackie Kennedy and to John Kennedy. And they gave him that nickname because they knew exactly what he was feeding the president.
How do you think they first approached him to get him as a doctor? What happened?
John Kennedy had a roommate from Harvard, and his name was Chuck Spalding. And during the 60 campaign, John Kennedy was running down. He was very hoarse. He had Addison's disease and his back injury. And his friend Chuck Spalding said, there's this great doctor. Everybody uses Gore Vidal and Truman Capote. And, you know, he's the doctor to the stars. He has this drug. I think he can really get you over, you know, your back. And so he took JFK, who was a senator at that point, running for president, to his office on Lexington Avenue. And John Kennedy walks into this shabby office. And out comes Max Jacobson in this lab coat with blood stains all over it. His hands, his nails are dirty. And he said, are you out of your mind, Chuck? And Chuck said, no. I'm telling you, John, this guy, Jack, is incredible. Jack Kennedy walked in barely, really, because he really had crutches at that point, because his back was just really aggravated from being on the campaign road.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked in and he walked out a new man. He said, Chuck, this is incredible. All of his pain, his back pain, and his voice came back. And from that moment on, he was the doctor to Jack Kennedy. I mean, he treated him almost like three times a week.
Jeez, with injections?
He injected in his neck.
God.
The incredible thing is, here's the race is very, very tight. Here come the debates, and he demands that Max Jacobson be there on the set when the Nixon-Kennedy debates began. And Nixon comes in, you know, with his, he's unshaven. And
yeah, no Kennedy, makeup.
No makeup. So Kennedy gets injected right in the neck, and it's instant. So this energy comes from Kennedy. He seems youthful and vibrant. And, you know, that probably was the tipping point when people saw Jack Kennedy as this vibrant, youthful, all this energy. And a lot of this energy comes from the methamphetamine that he created.
Now, is this the same kind of methamphetamine that we saw in Breaking Bad, those kinds of TV shows?
No, it's a different type of methamphetamine where his was a injectable rather than
snorting.
Were they snorting or other, you know, where they could smoke it? He injected it right into either the neck or an ankle
or into a wrist area, and it was instant, and it was far more powerful, far more potent than what they're even that kind of methamphetamine.
Did it go right into the carotid artery?
It went right into the artery. You know, it was instant energy. And everybody I've talked to who really were patients of Max Jacobson, great actors, they would go on stage, you know, even from Sinatra, they gave that energy.
Oh, Richard, stay with us. Going to hit the break, but we'll come right back and talk more about Dr. Feelgood. That's the name of the book right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Richard Lutzman with us. His book, Dr. Feelgood, he co-wrote it with Bill Burns. Bill, of course, wrote three books with me and also wrote the bestseller The Day After Roswell on the story of Colonel Philip Corso. Now, Bill is a great researcher, Richard, isn't he?
Oh, Bill is incredible. Bill is one of the brilliant minds, and I love working with him.
And he starred in UFO Hunters, too. That was a great TV show.
Yes, he did.
So he's injecting JFK. JFK is beginning to feel great. Then he starts into Jackie. How did that happen?
Jackie had a miscarriage, and she suffered from postpartum depression. And he brought Jackie. She was about to do the White House tour, and Jack Kennedy brought in Max Jacobson, injected Jackie, and Jackie, who was very camera shy, this gave her that kind of that energy and confidence that she didn't have. And after that, she was a patient of Max Jacobson's up until he got disbarred, and even after that.
And how did the word get around, Richard, that Max was the Dr. Feelgood type? How did all these other superstars get to him?
He started out, he was actually a self-promoter. He started out in the late 40s, and he started treating Eddie Cantor. He started treating, actually, Eddie Fisher was his first major star. He was working at the Borscht Belt and working at the Catskills, and Eddie Fisher became a big customer. Milton Blackstone was Eddie's manager and his PR man, and he was a patient of Max Jacobson's. And so word spread around Broadway that he can cure you. He can get you on stage, give you this great energy. So all of a sudden, the agent for Rod Serling, the same agent was Rod Serling, Truman Capote, Tennessee Williams. She was one of the great literary agents. She thought it brought Patty Chayefsky, she thought it brought energy and creativity. Mm-hmm. You know, she didn't know the effects of what it was. So a lot of these great writers who were writing television dramas, especially Chayefsky and Serling, were writing, because there were so many blacklisted writers, they were just doing script after script. And Rod was writing Patterns and Requiem for a Heavyweight and The Comedian and all these great dramas. And this kind of gave him that energy and that creative flow. And so a lot of writers went to him, and then a lot of performers. Eddie brought Elizabeth Taylor, at that time his friend, and then eventually his wife, as a patient. And then it spread like wildfire throughout the entertainment community.
Was it legal to inject people?
It was not a class 2 narcotic, which it eventually became. So it was not illegal because no one knew the contents. It wasn't approved by the FDA, but it was over-the-counter. Amphetamine was over-the-counter at that point. So it was not illegal, but there was a very gray area of what he was doing.
Did he feel good about his patients?
He would like to be in a position of power and control. He liked to control the lives of his patients. Marilyn Monroe was his patient. In fact, when Marilyn Monroe sang Happy Birthday, Mr. President, mm-hmm. people assumed, here's Marilyn Monroe, and she's drinking, and she's tipsy. She was actually injected with 30 milligrams of methamphetamine.
Jeez, that's probably why she was late coming out on stage.
That's exactly why she was late. Max was sitting there with a bag. Jack Kennedy brought him in, and he injected her in the neck, and she came out and had that slurry, Happy Birthday, Mr. President.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Now, you talk about control, Richard. Bobby Kennedy, the president's brother and attorney general, watched over the president like crazy.
Yes.
How did he let Dr. Feelgood do these things to his brother?
I got to know a gentleman named Michael Samick. He became the senior vice president of ITT. Brilliant man. He emigrated from Czechoslovakia, became a great war hero, United States war hero, with the silent gliders. A brilliant man. He had his own private jet, and he would fly Max to Washington like three times a week. On one of his trips, and I got to interview Michael, and I got to know him very well, and he was in his late 80s. And Michael flew with Max. What Max didn't know is that Bobby Kennedy had taken out vials out of Max's bag during one of his trips and had it analyzed. And here he found out, you know, it was methamphetamine, steroids, human placenta, and Bobby was fuming. So when Max and Michael walked through the gates to see the president, Bobby was red-faced, and he said, "I know what you're doing. I know exactly you're just and he called him an anti-Semitic name, and he said, "I know exactly what you're doing. You're never going to treat my brother. Go back to New York. Take your bag. Take your crap with you, and never come here ever again." So Max Jacobson went back to New York and wrote a letter of resignation that he sent to Evelyn Lincoln, who was the president's secretary. And the president went berserk. I mean, this was
his thing, right?
He depended on it, and Jackie depended on it. So he flew to the Carlyle Hotel in New York City, which was his getaway. And he called up Max Jacobson, and he said, "Dr. Jacobson, I need you here right now. You cannot resign." So he came in, and they made amends, and Max injected him with 30 milligrams of methamphetamine. And he said, no, I've been away from it for a week. Give me a double dose."
Oh, my God.
And he gave a double dose of methamphetamine.
This is to the president.
This is to the president of the United States. And Paul Landis, who was the Secret Service agent to John Kennedy, was standing there. And as soon as Max left, the president went through a psychotic breakdown. He started taking off all of his clothes, started running naked up and down the Carlyle Hotel. Then he was going down the stairwell, and in the floor below were all the reporters.
Oh.
So here's Paul Anderson. We don't know what to do. We can't put the president in a straitjacket. You know, this is a man who controls the atomic bomb. I mean, he's running around nude. So they call up, and we got to interview Larry Hatterer. Dr. Larry Hatterer was the chief of psychiatry at Cornell University in Cornell Hospital. And Larry Hatterer came in and injected the president with a downer that brought him down. And he asked the Secret Service, he goes, who treated this? He said, "Dr. Max Jacobson." So he called him up. He said, "Dr. Jacobson, my name is Larry Hatterer. I'm the chief of psychiatry. I just treated the president. What did you give him?" And he goes, "I can tell you, it's a secret formula. But what I can do is you come to my office, Dr. Hatterer, and I will give you an injection, and then you could see what it does." And so, you know, Larry Hatterer said, you know, "No way." And even though he went through that episode, he remained John Kennedy's doctor throughout the rest of his life.
Could this injection have killed Kennedy or anybody else who got it?
This injection could kill him, and it also affected his thinking, his process. Max Jacobson traveled with John Kennedy to the Vienna summit. He was there with them during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We've got all the plane logs. We went through the Freedom of Information Act and got file after file. We went to the Kennedy Library, and the Kennedy's White House physicians, Janet Travell and the other doctors, hated this man. They thought, because they hear Janet Travell was treating him with Procaine and Novocaine for his back, and they didn't know what to do. And Kennedy just was adamant that he remain as his personal physician. And absolutely, in the end, if Kennedy survived, I mean, you know, who knows what effect? But it was a bad effect. It affected everybody who took methamphetamine from Max Jacobson. Really, were affected in the end in an adverse way.
Jacobson died in 79. 16 years after Kennedy died. Did he continue treating people even after Kennedy died?
He continued as a physician, very powerful in New York, had a lot of friends. And the New York Times, at the point of Watergate, were anxious to get a story. So they were tipped off, and this is Brent Rensenberger from the New York Times, who was who read a team of reporters, really some of the top reporters in the New York Times. They were tipped off that Spiro Agnew was a patient of a man named Max Jacobson. So Brent Rensenberger and Dr. Larry Altman, who's also a reporter for the New York Times, he was until recently, staked out Max's office. And he was under the radar. Nobody knew, you know, the celebrities knew who he was, but the Times and really no insiders knew who Max Jacobson was. And they stood outside the office and they watched as Truman Capote, Alan J. Lerner, Senator Claude Pepper, writers, politicians, they would come out of his office and they just could not believe what they saw. So they went into Max's office, and Max thought this is the time that he's going to be recognized. So he told them, he said, you know, I was a doctor to John Kennedy. I'm still a doctor to Jackie Kennedy. And Larry Altman, who's a physician also, besides being a reporter for the New York Times, saw blood dripping from Max's, he had just taken an injection. So Max brought out the vial. He said, I'll show you the vial. And in it was radioactive rocks. When you shut the lights, they lit up in the dark, his vial of methamphetamine. And he was proud of it. He told them all about it. And as they started digging, they started interviewing Jackie Kennedy. They interviewed Larry Altman, who we talked about earlier, who treated Kennedy, mm-hmm. brought him down from that drug in the Carlisle. They did a massive expose in the New York Times in 1972, front page. It exposed, Tennessee Williams said, you know, he almost killed me. Truman Capote said he just, you know, I wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's and I wrote In Cold Blood with this, but he almost killed me. I felt like Superman, but then I crashed. And then
and they were addicted to this too, weren't they?
They were addicted to it, and it besides that, it destroyed their creative process. It was great in the beginning, but it eventually destroyed them. And he was exposed. And what happened was, and before that was that Richard Nixon knew that Kennedy was treated with the methamphetamine before the debates, so he had come to Max Jacobson, and Max Jacobson had treated them a little bit, but he then refused when he found out Nixon was drinking heavily. And Jacobson...
Bad combination, I guess,
right? He refused to... Anybody who drank that heavy could not be treated with the drug. And when he did that, he had an enemy in Nixon. And Nixon brought down... he created, really, laws and everything to prevent people like Max Jacobson from practicing.
Wow. He went after Jacobson through the FDC, probably, right?
He did. He created FDA. A lot of it. The laws in 72, the drug laws that were created really for Max Jacobson. He had that much of an effect, and Nixon really brought down the House on Max Jacobson, who was eventually disbarred through New York State. It took quite a few years.
Why did Jackie throw Feelgood under the bus?
Jackie, when he was being tried or being disbarred and taken before the New York, she was panic-stricken. She thought, he's going to expose me when he goes before the board. And she brought Louis Neiser, who was a famed attorney, and she said, Max, Louis will represent you. Louis will take care of all your bills. Do not talk about me. Mm-hmm. You can talk in generalities about my husband, but just very general. And, you know, we've always trusted you, and you can't expose us.
It's got to be doctor-patient relationship, right?
She was panic-stricken that this would come out. So Chuck Spalding and everybody in the inside of the Kennedys came to Max and said, listen, we'll take care of you. In fact, they didn't take care of him. I got to know Max's wife, who just said, you know, Jackie was just, you know, she just really disliked her, and that she really, they all threw Max under the bus. And once he got disbarred, he was really a broken man.
All kinds of theories on what happened to John F. Kennedy, the assassination, whether Oswald acted alone. I don't think he did. That's one of the theories. Some people say that he was going to reveal stories about UFOs. They wanted to do him in there. And there's also, as you've talked about, the CIA maybe wanted to eliminate JFK because he was an addicted person?
What really alerted the CIA was that episode at the Carlisle. Because here's the man with his finger on the nuclear warheads with the codes.
Stoned out of his mind, basically.
And he is absolutely out of his mind. And he had the same reaction that when Kennedy traveled to the Vienna summit, here he's meeting with Nikita Khrushchev, and Max Jacobson is sitting right next to him in a vestibule. He injects the president with 30 milligrams of methamphetamine. He goes in, but Khrushchev is brilliant. He's brilliant in gamemanship. He knew how to play Kennedy, and he had inside information on Kennedy that he was addicted to methamphetamine. So he made Kennedy wait and wait and wait. And then as the drug was wearing off, Kennedy ran out again to Max Jacobson, and he said, "Inject me again." He goes, "Mr. President, this is going to affect you. He goes, "No, no, no." And he demanded that he inject him with another 30 milligrams of meth. So here's the president, gets injected again. He comes into Khrushchev, and he's slurring his words. He can't talk. And here's Khrushchev, who knew, here's this.
He knew what was going on, right?
And he knew exactly, because Max Jacobson was an agent, had given information to the KGB. Here's Khrushchev, who knew he had this man, and he really had no respect for him. And Kennedy can't negotiate. He can't do anything. He can barely speak to Khrushchev. And when he walks out, Kennedy knew exactly that he was overdrugged. And here's the CIA who's looking at this and goes, "This man, we're in big trouble." And the Dulleses could not stand Kennedy. And so we've talked to Secret Service agents. We even talked to certain CIA operatives who told us, they were all panic-stricken that our country would be destroyed if Kennedy continued on with Max Jacobson.
He was destructive, and he was out of control, wasn't he, Kennedy?
He was. And the drug does all kinds of – this is not a typical taking amphetamine or methamphetamine or something like we see with Walter White. This is far more effective, far more potent. And what he created, and I've talked firsthand to people like Andy Williams, who was a patient, Angie Dickinson, Burt Bacharach, people who were patients of Max, and they told me how potent it was. Johnny Mathis.
Jeez, he had them all.
Oh, the patient list just, when you go, it's a who's who of writers and performers. Cecil B. DeMille was a patient of his.
Rod Serling?
Rod Serling was a patient of his. Rod Serling, part of what we did was I was doing research about Bob Cummings, who was a great actor who was a patient of Max's. And
he was a comedian, right?
He was an A-list actor for Hitchcock, and then he became a comedian.
Yeah, I remember him. When was
a show called Love That Bob.
That's right.
And he was a patient, and he did an episode of The Twilight Zone called King Nine Will Not Return. And I got to talk to Del Reisman, who was the producer and writer with Rod Serling of the Twilight Zone. And they traveled out to Barstow. And Rod Serling smoked a lot, and he ate huge steaks. And Bob Cummings was a health fanatic. He took vitamin pills, and he ate very carefully and health foods. And he said, "Rod, you're not going to live to 50."
And that's how old he was when he died.
When he died. And Bob Cummings and Rod Serling were both patients of Rod Serling. And
you mean of Max?
Max Jacobson. They were both patients of Max Jacobson. For Rod did not continue as a patient of Max Jacobson, while Bob Cummings did his whole life, and it destroyed his career.
Let's talk about Elvis, Richard, when we come back, and we'll take some phone calls as well. Richard Lertzman, our special guest, the book Dr. Feelgood that he wrote with Bill Burns, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.